ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
John was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Natasha Mitchell, and if you're in Melbourne, why not join me for a wonderful event with the founder of that celebration of collective joy and song that goes by the name of Pub Choir. You might have seen Astrid Jorgensen's moving story on ABC's Australian Story recently. Just look for Be In Our Audience down the bottom of the Big Ideas homepage for the link to book. Now, just build more houses. That'll fix Australia's housing crisis, won't it? Big Ideas comes to you today from the recent National Housing Conference in Perth on Whadjuk Noongar country, with a panel I hosted asking, is supply the silver bullet? Because if you listen to governments, you'd sure think so.
This idea of, well, as long as we just keep building new houses, that's going to make housing more affordable for everyone. I cannot buy the argument that if you build a new house in, I don't know, Peppermint Grove, that's a really wealthy area in Perth, that's somehow going to benefit a single older woman who's on the verge of homelessness.
Nothing's ever a guarantee, but I can tell you if you don't build more houses, you won't get more affordable house pricing. Affordability is a very challenging issue in this country, but you're not going to get there without building more houses. So it is actually a part of this story. But I think it's important that we say, what are we building? You know, affordable product is different for everybody. It depends what you need and who you are and the circumstances you're in.
Everybody's been going through the same crisis. They are not all governed by the New South Wales planning system. Every single country you look at in the G20 has had some problem. The thing that unifies them is cheap money over the last 20 years to keep the world economy afloat, interest rates at a historically low level, and no public housing. That's what unites them. What doesn't unite them is their planning system.
Although planning system blocks and conflicts are often in the media spotlight, aren't they? Under the National Housing Accord, the National Cabinet has committed to a target of building 1.2 million new so-called well-located homes over 5 years. Now, all states and territories have signed on, but none look set to meet the targets. And is supply a solution to the fundamental problems of housing affordability, housing quality, security of tenure, and that growing gap between housing haves and have-nots in this country? Or is it just the politically palatable solution for governments avoiding the elephant in the room, tax reform? Joining me on the stage at the Perth Convention Centre on Big Ideas today, David Reynolds is the Chief Executive of the South Australian Government's Department of Housing and Urban Development. Professor Rachel Vforge is the John Curtin Distinguished Professor of Economics at Curtin University, amongst other roles, and a leading researcher in housing policy, affordability and intergenerational housing issues. Dr. Tim Williams is from the architecture firm Grimshaw, where he's the global practice leader Cities. He was CEO of the Committee for Sydney and, as a Welshman, advised five consecutive housing ministers back in the UK. And I'm starting with Tim. Is supply a silver bullet?
There's a dialogue of the deaf going on at the moment. Between two-thirds of the room here know that housing supply is necessary but not sufficient to solve the housing crisis. But housing lobbyists, I think, have captured the attention around the supply discussion, and we're not even delivering the supply, right? So the numbers already are less than 2019, despite all the palaver and all the government support for the private sector. We have a private sector crisis on our hands, not a public sector crisis on our hands. People are ignoring it.
What do you mean by the dialogue of death?
The dialogue of the deaf is because normally in a business, if you throw more things into the market, the price goes down. That's not true with housing. It's not as simple as that with housing for reasons that we will discuss. But people talk as though it is, right? And secondly, they talk as though once we've achieved this magical number of housing, that in some unstated amount, it will drop. Nobody ever says what they mean by affordability. Nobody, you know, for example, do we mean the level of affordability was in Australia in the 1980s when four times your salary could buy a home? Do we mean that? Twice as many people today, for example, can't afford a home under 35. Do we mean by affordable to restore affordability to 35-year-olds? I don't think we have a genuine or honest discussion about what we mean. And secondly, we confuse it with affordable housing, which we need more of. And definitely need more supply of, but it's not the same. And the two are not really that closely connected, actually. We need more affordable housing. What the government is doing is not going to deliver housing affordability.
Lots to unpack there. Right. Rachel, what about you? Is housing supply the silver bullet?
Well, Natasha, I think crises rarely have a simple solution.
And funny that.
Yeah, housing is no different. So I think we are in a situation where we have a housing crisis. It's taken a while to get here, and it could not have happened because of one single factor. And therefore, there is no one single solution. So I think, you know, my headline answer is basically no. Supply is not a silver bullet. In fact, nothing is a silver bullet. I think what we need is a package of solutions. I'll just make some really quick points. I think the real question here is should be about how do we make housing more affordable rather than just how do we increase supply? Because there are other factors at play. Supply is kind of half the problem if you want to look at it in an economic framework, because the other half is demand, which is how much of housing do people want. So that goes into the more thornier aspects of the debates around, you know, population planning, tax reform, that I think that are politically difficult. But yet, I think these are things that we need to talk about bravely and emotionally, because we can't just be looking at half the problem. That's a big issue there. Another point that I would like to make, I think, which is really important, is that when we talk about supply, we tend to say supply, but what we really mean is new supply. And when you think about it, when you look at the total housing stock in Australia, 98% of our housing stock already exists. So these are established dwellings. So when we have new supply come onto the market, that's adding about 2% to the housing stock every year. Now, that's important. Yes, it is, of course. But there's another 98% that we don't think enough about how we can better utilise the existing housing stock.
How would you see us better utilising existing housing stock in this conversation about supply?
Yeah, well, you see, it's the level of housing supply that affects prices. So when we increase new supply, that's really great. It's adding to the housing stock, but it's usually not adding enough or quickly enough to actually affect supply, so to affect prices. So you really have to look at the other 90%. One simple example is that there's often discussions around a mismatch in, you know, between the size of the household that's living in a dwelling and the size of the dwelling. You know, maybe a single individual living in a four-bedroom house, or we have, on the other hand, a growing family living in an overcrowded situation, then there's a mismatch between household need and the dwelling that's available. But we can actually make it easier for people to kind of shift into houses in locations that they would prefer to, if we were willing to deal with things that hinder the effective exchange of houses between individuals and households. And of course, one of those areas is, if you look at stamp duty, for instance, it is a barrier to home purchase, but it is also a barrier to people who want to downsize. It's a barrier to people who want to upsize. So that's an issue that's at play. And again, that plays into the area of tax reform, of course. And when you talk about tax, there's always winners and there's losers. So that's where it becomes difficult. But one of the ways in which we can better utilise our housing stock is to look at transaction costs that are preventing people from moving.
So your concern is that we're centering the supply conversation at the expense of not discussing other important policy levers.
I think there's certainly that at play.
David Reynolds from South Australia. So do you think that supply is a silver bullet? You're in charge of a department that is responsible for fast-tracking supply in your state. There's been an identified problem of supply. It's taken many decades to build. Silver bullet or not?
Silver bullets are always an interesting question. And as my colleagues have said, it's a complex issue. But supply is part of the answer. We're not going to get anywhere forward without building more houses. And I don't think any of us disagree with that. You're right, 2% per year is what we're add to our housing stock. So over 5 years, we're adding 10% more houses in this country. And I think that is an important part of making sure we're taking actions we need to. Of course, it's not the only action, and that's the important part of this conversation. It's what are we building? And what are we trying to achieve as we build those houses to make sure we've got diversity of housing and we make sure we're building different housing types for different people who need different outcomes? And that's what we're really trying to focus on. So I actually think housing is much more of a, I'm inclined to the yes part of this rather than the no in terms of the silver bullet, because we know it is a big part of the answer. We have to have more houses. You know, if we had twice as many houses, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
So paint the picture in South Australia, the challenge that you have ahead of you. What's led you to this point? How significant is the supply situation in South Australia?
So I think our supply challenge is pretty much the same as everyone else's. So we don't have a difference in that. We've all kind of got here over a long period of time. In our case, quite a bit of underinvestment in infrastructure, and that is water and wastewater systems to make sure that we've got land that is developable. You know, in South Australia, we don't have a problem of not enough land. We have land that we can build houses on, but it's not in a developable state. So what we've really been focusing on is making sure we can get water, wastewater, roads, stormwater infrastructure right.
Well, you've got that pretty much all in your portfolio.
I do, which is
when do you get time to sleep?
Rarely, you know, but these are things
SA Water is now in your portfolio alongside housing, alongside urban development.
Yes, that's correct. So we've got all of these things, which for the first time, and this is a first thing in the country, no one's done this, we've brought them all together, and that has worked very effectively. I must say it's worked even better than I thought it would, to make sure we're actually having the right conversations, because it's amazing how disjointed bureaucracies can become. You know, we've all talked about silos in government. They're fairly easy to find, and the way through them is always communication. And we've created those communication channels, which means we are now focused on getting the infrastructure in the right places so we can get houses more quickly.
What are you doing differently?
So if we talk about our water authority, developers would talk to them about where they wanted infrastructure, and they wouldn't really have a great link to the rest of government and where our planning agency is thinking that houses are going. So if we'd had the conversation with our water authority where they thought houses were going, our planning authority where they thought developments were going to be, they'd have different answers. And that was really challenging. And since we worked that out, we start bringing these conversations together, we realised that we can actually then put our efforts into maximising the outcomes. You know, because we recognise we're in a housing crisis, we need to act like we're in this crisis to move more quickly and actually making sure we just take steps forward. One of the challenges I have with this kind of debate is it's, you know, there are multiple issues, there are complex issues. And we always get stuck into this question of, do we try and solve every issue? Or do we get on and just start building, start trying to solve some things that are in front of us, and then seek to add on additional solutions as we go?
Okay, but one of the concerns, and we'll let's expand this out now, but one of the concerns is, okay, it's been raised, will increasing supply guarantee a reduction in house prices? Can you make houses more affordable as you increase supply?
Well, nothing's ever a guarantee, but I can tell you if you don't build more houses, you won't get more affordable house pricing. Affordability is a very challenging issue in this country, but you're not going to get there without building more houses. So it is actually a part of this story. But I think it's important that we say, what are we building? And I think, you know, affordable product is different for everybody. It depends what you need and who you are and the circumstances you're in. So diversity of that house, additional house supply, is much more important. We can't just keep building quarter acre blocks or townhouses until we run to the horizon. We've got to actually think about what we build so we can build different products which can be affordable to different markets.
Tim Williams, the Grattan Institute reports that we have the least housing stock per person in the developed world. Australia is one of just four OECD countries to have gone backwards over the last 20 years.
They can't count.
Back on this. You think we're not doing too badly on the supply side?
I was amazed when I read not just the Grattan report. So when Jim Chalmers, again, I was astonished, in the Treasury papers, justifying the excellent investment that I welcome that the federal government made into housing, said that Australia had one of the poorest performances of housing delivery. Well, here's a couple of numbers for you to put it in context. So Australia wants to build 1.2 million homes over 5 years. Why does Britain only want to build 1.5 million homes over 5 years? I.e., that suggests that we're 2.5 times more efficient than the British at building homes, given we've got a population of 27 million, they've got a population of 69 million. Britain is a low performer. Australia is a high performer by international standards. Part of the problem with Australia, though, and its challenge, is that its population is growing faster than most other countries. So it has to run to stay almost where it is. Can it go back to the 98 to 2%? That's really important for listeners to understand this, you know. So the house prices are set by the 98% that already exist. You might imagine that if we're producing 10 or 15% extra home a year, the house prices might go down. But guess what the development sector would do at that point? They would stop building. Because this is the thing I do not understand about the discussion. That, you know, people have developed a kind of fantasy island housing economics. In the real world, as we've seen over the last 4 years, where housing viability has been smashed after COVID internationally, by the way, of all the 20 G20 countries, guess how many have not delivered their housing targets in the last 5 years? And the answer is 20, right? There's an international housing crisis going on. And the discussion in Australia is too introspective about if only we built 3 or 4% extra, everything would be okay. It's bigger than that. So housing is different. Even if we ramped up dramatically to 4%, it's not going to have much impact on house prices in our capital cities. So that's the dialogue of the deaf, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. What impact do we think this supply will have on affordability? Not very much. On homelessness? Not very much. On ownership levels amongst young people? Not very much. So my question would be, what answer, if 1.2 million homes is the answer, what's the question?
That's a very good question indeed. What do you think the question should be?
The question should be what we heard early on is, how do we restore affordability levels to the early 80s? So basically we need to say to ourselves, do we want to give people a right to shelter? That's a good one. Yes. Do we want to restore affordability levels to ownership levels, share of ownership levels, young people, poorer people being able to own a home? Yes, we do. So I think those are the kind of questions we want answers to. Do we want housing investment to play the absurdly large role it plays in Australian economic development when we've got one of the lowest, least complex economies in the universe, but the highest house prices? Do we not think there's a link between the fact that we're not putting enough money into innovation sectors, but we're putting too much money into making people landlords? Is what Australian housing policy has been doing. So for me, we're asking the wrong questions.
Dr. Tim Williams from the architecture firm Grimshaw, former advisor to 5 UK housing ministers and to the Greater Sydney Commission on Major Infrastructure Projects. Natasha Mitchell here, joining you from the National Housing Conference in Perth. Here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. And you can share this episode from the ABC Listen app or listen again. Just download it to your phone and search for Big Ideas. Now, we are wrestling with the question, is housing supply the silver bullet fix for Australia's housing crisis, as governments might like us to believe? Also joining me, David Reynolds, who heads up the South Australian Government's Department of Housing and Urban Development, and was former head of state treasury and finance, and also leading housing researcher, economist Professor Rachel VForge. Now, would building more houses make homes overall more affordable for all?
Rachel VForge, are there any examples, and I think of a case study in Auckland, for example, but where are the examples that say that supply, increasing housing supply, increases housing affordability domestically and internationally?
Well, Auckland's often been cited as a success story.
They rezoned
and allow more dwellings, greater density in areas that are close to jobs in the inner city areas, and therefore, by implication, allow greater housing, new housing supply in areas where there's more jobs and more public transport, etc.
So there was a building boom of medium to high density housing.
Yes, that's right. And also, Auckland's been cited as a success story because it's reported that housing became more affordable over there.
So rental prices dropped.
Yes, but I think you have to look at some of the more nuanced complexities. And I think I would simply put forward the point that every city and every region is different.
And let's be clear, Auckland is still an extremely unaffordable city for many people.
Well, house prices have started rising again in Auckland, so whatever affordability gains that came out over the last few years are being reversed as we speak. For every Auckland, there's another example of another city where greater housing supply has not led to a reduction in house prices.
It did annoy me, this thing about Auckland. When people talked about it, they didn't look at Sydney. So Sydney, in the same period that Auckland showed this increase in housing delivery, trebled its housing delivery. Sydney went from 13,000 homes after the crash in 2011 to 39, 40,000 by 2018, and prices went up. By the way, delivery of housing went up during COVID, stupidly and strangely enough, and prices went up. And I don't know if anybody has worked in the private sector like I have, but basically, we put more stock into the market when prices go up, not when they go down. So we're looking in the completely the wrong direction. What we're missing is the thing that's missing from all the discussions in England and in Australia is that, I give you an example, in 1975 in England, 40% of all housing was public housing. And when we stopped building public housing in 1975, the private sector response was zero extra homes. They built exactly the same year in, year out, even though the population increased by 5 million. So for me, the missing discussion about housing is, can Australia go back to being the house building society it was post-war, when 10 to 15% of all homes were public housing, non-market housing? I believe that would have some restraining effect on private sector uplift in housing value, but not the 2% we're producing through the private development line only. I think people don't need to get out more and compare what's happening in Australia to what's happening internationally. Everybody's been going through the same crisis. They are not all governed by the New South Wales planning system. Every single country you look at in the G20 has had some problem. The thing that unifies them is cheap money over the last 20 years to keep the world economy afloat, interest rates at historically low level, and no public housing. That's what unites them. What doesn't unite them is their planning systems. So I wouldn't want anybody here to think there's proof that what stops housing being cheap in Australia is its planning systems. That's displacement activity. That's nonsense.
Well, we'll come to the planning system, because it has been identified by many players, including the Productivity Commission in their recent report, as a major factor in limiting supply in Australia and not meeting the housing accord targets. Rachel, we were discussing where there has been evidence that increasing supply can actually decrease housing affordability. You also say that we don't pay enough, and you alluded to this earlier, enough to the demand side, but also to developer behaviour. So to just articulate that a little further for us, this is vital, isn't it, in this conversation about affordability and increasing supply?
Yeah, I think so. And even if we wanted to, in my view, of course, is that, new supply is one way, one of many ways of getting towards more affordable housing. So we need to do many things, not just build more houses. But even if we wanted to just focus on building more new houses, we're having problems with that. And a key reason is that the housing production process, the act of starting from, land release, land assembly and all that, all the way to putting a house out onto the market, is a pretty complicated process. The whole process involves planning, it involves, development finance, it involves construction, and we know, for instance, right now, there's, we need a whole lot, many, many more construction workers if we're going to meet the 1.2 million housing target. I think Master Builders Australia has, they've estimated we need another 130,000 workers in the construction industry if we're going to get there. So there's construction, and there's also developer behaviour. And a key aspect of that is that developers are rational, profit makers. Okay, we're talking about market housing here. So if we're asking developers to deliver on affordability, I think that's a pretty tough ask, because if they can't make a project feasible, they're not going to build it, because it's not going to generate sufficient return for them to justify doing that. So there are actually...
And in many cases, and increasingly so, I gather, high-density developments, they're just not commercially viable.
That's right. And there's actually many examples of instances where development applications for apartments have been approved many years ago, and construction hasn't actually started. I actually spoke to a colleague from New South Wales recently, and I said, do you have some examples? And he sent me some addresses. So look, go to the New South Wales planning portal, look up 34 Tallawong Road, Tallawong. Okay, so back in October 2022, the development application for 914 apartments were approved, and construction has not started there. There's 22 Queen Street, Campbelltown, where the development application for 548 apartments were approved back in August 2023. Construction has not started there.
So there's a lot at work there, though, isn't there? What are some of the variables that are holding back construction? Is it about commercial viability? Is it other things?
That's a big deal, especially when you're talking about apartments. They are expensive to build, much more expensive than houses. And there are many factors at play. Look, you know, taxes affect construction. They affect developers as well. Interest rates do as well. So there's all these factors just affecting the delivery of new houses onto the market.
I feel like a great moment and a wave of empathy for developers coming over me. And I need to say, you know, if you've got Lendlease saying, I think to the market about 9 months ago, that they couldn't do bog standard housing anymore because they couldn't make any money from it. And the reason is not the planning system. It's the viability problem that they have, that they bought land or they optioned it 5 years ago. Land prices shot up, cost of borrowing shot up, no access to skills post-COVID, construction materials go up 40%. So a lot of these optioned and approved planning permissions that are out there can't be progressed, not because, you know, somebody in Woollahra is holding up Australia, you know, in the planning department, but because it's not viable. They've had real objective difficulties. It was one of the strangest things, I thought, in the announcement 2 years ago, was it, when the government, federal government said we're going to do 1.2 million. They announced it at the very moment that the world system of housing went into crisis. And it just makes you wonder where they get advice from, you know.
The National Housing Supply and Affordability Council, on which Rachel sits, recently gave us the housing system snapshot with the forecasts that the Housing Accord target of 1.2 million houses by 2029 will not be met, and no state or territory is going to meet its targets under the Accord either. So there are some clear barriers, aren't there, David Reynolds?
And certainly in a South Australia context, same problem. These things are not viable to be able to develop. Yeah. The only apartments you can probably get away to market are in the city, and they have to be pretty much more than $1 million each in apartments, which is way above the average house price in Adelaide, to be able to get them away to make the project viable. So we're not getting any affordable housing outcomes out of any housing projects for apartments that work. So that is a policy challenge that we need to do more about to make sure we're helping those get developed. But if we go out to greenfield sites, out on the edge of the suburbs, where people are building houses, no problems for developers out there. They can make money and they can continue to build houses in those areas.
And you're prioritising greenfields areas in your state, yes?
We are, because it's the thing that works easiest. So we are, in terms of getting stock up, we absolutely move to much more prioritising of greenfield sites out in the suburbs and continue to grow, because we know we can get stock. But it is then a challenge between developers. And if you're a developer, your job is to maximise your profits.
Yeah.
So how much supply do you put into the market? And so one of the things we've been talking a lot about is making sure we're getting developers to put more supply in, compete with each other, have a market. And one thing we know, the government owns a range of land out in these areas. So we're putting our own land into the market with actual contracts with these developers, but with timelines on them to make sure you use it or you lose it.
See,
make
I think
sure we're actually delivering more houses and getting the product in there in a way that will help get the competition into the market.
And are developers responding?
Yeah, absolutely, because they can see, again, they can make money out of this because we've got the land, we'll sell it out there, so they can make profits from building these houses. So they're responding and getting out there, and we're building more houses in these areas, which means we're at least localised, we're getting some respite on the house price growth that's been out in this zone.
One of the things that does annoy me about this is the governments have been bending over backwards, you know, really, to try and take the horse to water to make it drink in terms of giving developers what they want around planning reforms and all sorts of innovations and investments and infrastructure and all this kind of stuff. But it's been slow to respond. The private sector has been slow to respond for viability reasons. But it is easier. David makes a very good point, but this is a challenging point to that bit of the federal government statement that he wants to build lots of new homes in well-located areas. That's code for...
The ultimate euphemism, I think.
But it's code for, you know, transit-oriented development around public transport in the inner city areas. These are the most difficult places, actually, to make viability stack up at this point in time. Also, we forget, I do think this is something we all forget internationally, is that it's much more difficult to build a block of flats than it is to build a bunch of separate standalone homes. And part of the slowdown is that we're asking people who have not done lots of housing apartment development board to go into this business because we haven't got a lot of apartment developers. So that's one thing. But the second thing is a financial thing, which I think is critical, which is one of the reasons I'm very critical of the Grattan report, because I don't think it understands the business model of house builders, which is that they have to satisfy their banks, or apartment builders are particularly exposed, they have to satisfy their banks that they will make a 20% return on capital employed before the banks will lend them money for the next brick, right? What it means is that if they can't get the pre-sales for the apartments, because the market's a bit tricky, no matter what the need is, no matter how much population growth in Melbourne, you know, those are not going to come forward. Because they can't get money from the banks because the pre-sales are not there. So government innovation, and you see a bit of this in New South Wales, where they are, you know, I think doing the right thing, state government, are looking at co-investing to de-risk some of this stuff. That's not just planning. That's public-private collaboration in a more robust way, taking some of the risk away from the private sector, but asking for something in return.
Housing expert Dr. Tim Williams having a go at the Grattan Institute think tank's strongly stated argument that housing is expensive in Australia because we haven't built enough of it. David Reynolds is driving the building of more houses in his state of South Australia, where he is head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Economist Professor Rachel Vforge is a leading housing policy researcher. And I'm Natasha Mitchell, bringing you ABC Radio National's Big Ideas from the stage of the National Housing Conference in Perth, with this plenary session I hosted on whether supply is a silver bullet. Rachel Vforge, let's talk about what we actually build. You know, there's this conversation about supply, but as you said, it depends. We should be talking about the specificity of location, of cities, of you know, different places in Australia have different requirements. The quality of what we're building, is there enough of a conversation about that? How do you think we should get nuanced about what we supply?
First of all, I think we need to get away from the narrative that we have a single housing market in Australia. I think we just need to stop that conversation because we do not have...
What's the problem with that conversation?
Well, the problem with that conversation is that it assumes that if you build one extra house in Perth, that it's going to benefit someone in Sydney, which is just not true. Okay, and it assumes that if you build, you know, two extra units in Alice Springs, that it's going to benefit someone in Melbourne, and that's just not true. This idea of, well, as long as we just keep building new houses, that's going to make housing more affordable for everyone. I think it's a flawed argument in my view. And even if that it was true, it would take ages for it to happen. And what you would need to do is just keep building lots of new houses over a very long period of time while preventing housing demand, which is the number of properties that people want, or preventing that from rising. Now, how do you do that? It's just impossible. So I think you really need to move away from this idea that there is a single housing market in Australia. Recognize the fact that the housing market is very segmented. The apartment sector operates very differently from the separate houses. Sydney operates very differently from Perth, from Brisbane, etc. And that also applies, I think, to the planning argument as well. I think the planning system is actually very localized. Every state's got a different planning system, in my view. And so this idea that somehow we can have some kind of some national measure that's going to change and improve planning for every single jurisdiction is a huge.
So you're
ask.
Making things more complicated.
Well, I mean,
how dare you?
Things are more complicated. It's, you know, it's probably easier to just go out there and say, let's just build our way out of this crisis, but I just don't think that it will get us to affordability, which is what we're looking for. I think affordability means, you know, not just building in the right places.
Affordability and equity of access, yeah?
That's right.
Is that what we're looking for?
Well, we're looking for affordability. We're looking, and linked to that is intergenerational equity. And also intra-generational equity as well. I mean, like, I cannot buy the argument that if you build a new house in, I don't know, Peppermint Grove, that's a really wealthy area in Perth, that's somehow going to benefit a single older woman who's on the verge of homelessness.
So what needs to change? How do we need? In what ways do we need to get more
specific, more fine-grained in this conversation about supply. We haven't talked about, well, what sort of housing are we talking about here? And what sorts of needs are being met through that housing?
That's right, and that's another complication, if I might dare add, because, you know, yes, we've been talking about density as a way of increasing new supply, but not all high-density housing is affordable. Some high-density housing is very expensive. So that's an issue. We also need to consider what young families aspire to. And, you know, not everyone wants to live in an apartment. And that's just a fact, that not everyone wants to raise a family in a small apartment. And those are things that we need to consider, which is, what are people's aspirations? What do they want for their families? We don't talk enough about that. I would also like to mention that, you know, like going back to this example of, if you build one new home in Peppermint Grove, that's just not going to affect someone on the verge of homelessness. Well, it does mean that, in my view, a targeted approach towards, you know, seriously increasing non-market housing, what I mean is social and affordable housing, I think would be one effective way of trying to address the more acute need that's at the lower end of the income and wealth distribution, which is amongst people who are living in poverty. So I think we need to do that. We have 170,000 households on a public housing wait list, and the social housing stock has grown at one-third the rate of population growth in all of Australia over the last 10 years. So what are we talking about?
And this is off a base of being wound back to a significant degree.
Yes, that's right. So that's an area where we could obviously be more targeted in terms of, and I know that the Housing Australia Future Fund is sort of trying to get us there. It's had a rocky start, but, you know, it's on its way, hopefully. But what we desperately need right now is a social housing target, you know, just looking at not just an overall 1.2 million well-located housing for anybody in the income distribution. But that's great. 1.2 million overall targets, great. But how about having a target within a target? How about having a social housing target? How about looking at the need amongst those who are in poverty and dealing directly with that?
Tim Williams, social housing is a big part of what you would like to see focused on in this conversation about supply.
Because I grew up in public housing, which we didn't call public housing, we called council housing, words matter. And it's funny, I've never been as warm about the term social housing, because it always feels like charitable giving, whereas public housing feels like a right, you know. And I think that I agree completely that we need a target to go back to. A proportion of every year we're going to do, 10% non-market housing in every city in Australia until we get back to 15% of all stock, because I think that was a healthy position to be in. All I'm saying is, I think in the discussion about what type of housing, definitely more public, and definitely more shared equity, by the way. I think it's a huge, we need to grow shared equity massively, I think. But I also think about the location discussion, we might have to be less earnest about our urbanist obsessions and maybe think about how we make the suburbs flourish again.
Mm.
High density living gets you a better environment, you know, healthy, wealthy and wise, you know, communities live closer to public transport, walkable, with canopy cover, and it's all that kind of stuff. You know, I suppose where I'm going is, I think we have to accept that it is easier to build in suburbia, and it's probably cheaper to own in suburbia, but we would like suburbia not quite as it is at the moment, for it to be much more of a kind of, I call it superbia, by the way, which is a kind of higher density, well, better connected, walkable kind of version.
David Reynolds from South Australia.
Can I just pick up on that point? And you're talking about, you know, new suburbs, what people build and what the product looks like. And we have this conversation with developers who, you know, want to build the houses out there, and say, can we put more density into these new suburbs, put some apartments, put that in there? And the answer we tend to get from developers is nobody wants to buy it. Nobody wants it. Now, the thing we sell is three-bedroom houses, and that's what we want to keep doing. I, to be honest, have never been convinced by this argument. I think that's what people think they want, because that's the only thing we're offering them. I'm actually not sure we're actually giving them the choice. They say, well, that's all they want. Well, that's the only choice they've got. It's like, going to a restaurant, there being one thing on the menu and wondering why everybody orders it. You know, it's absolutely what we keep doing. So we've been talking to them about, okay, how can we make this innovation change? Let's end where we've got government land out there that we can do different things on. We're going to build some different product to try and market lead to prove that this product is saleable. So we're building some smaller dwellings for different types of people, and there'll be a cheaper price point that people can actually then get there to do it. Because we have an affordable housing policy, inclusionary zoning is the technical term, which means for all these new developments, 15% of them have to be in an affordable price point. But we can do more than that with our own properties and our own land that goes out there and provide different type of product, which I think is the job of government here.
Weirdly, we always think of the private sector as being intrinsically innovative. In housing, it's not been, right? It's particularly housing at scale, not your standalone rich person's house where like a star architect can do something interesting and all that stuff. Bog standard housing, it's not been very innovative. What's been innovative is the public sector in housing, because actually, if you're a developer, and it's really kind of a risky business, and nobody in the chain wants you to be innovative because that's going to lead to disaster, perhaps the public sector role could be, and is, by the way, historically, to de-risk some of the innovation, right? Around, for example, energy efficiency is a good example, where you know the governments might have done housing, which shows the private sector how to do that, so that they don't have to be first to do it, somebody else has done it for us. And the stuff around public-private collaboration, the inclusionary zoning thing must not be, your listeners, inclusionary zoning is requiring a mandatory amount of housing from that the private sector should provide, perhaps with the government or through a community housing provider. We hear scare stories across Australia that this will destroy the viability of private sector development. That is completely untrue. And the reason why it works in every other part of the universe is we tell the developers before they buy the land that they're going to be doing 10 or 15% for submarket. And in those terms, it's not unaffordable.
I think
we must kill that myth now.
I think it's an important point that you make, that innovation happens in the public sector. I think we often forget that conversation, that somehow there's this assumption, almost a stereotype, almost a stigma, that innovation only happens in the private sector, and that's just simply not true. Fact doesn't play that out. David Reynolds, I was interested in a press club address given by Danielle Woods, the Productivity Commissioner, where she talked about, you know, increasing the productivity of the construction industry in Australia and listing all the various ways in which it isn't historically and to this present day. And she talked about the sorts of tough choices that we might have to make, people in your role have to make, in order to get things cracking and meet targets of supply. Things like pitting heritage and density restrictions up against enabling more and cheaper houses, or pitting government procurement rules and prioritising local jobs and small businesses up against increasing the opportunities for lower cost infrastructure provision, but also increasing the requirements for energy efficiency in the construction code versus making it faster, cheaper to provide housing. Do you prioritise future energy savings? So are you wrestling with some of those compromises? Do you see, I was sort of surprised that she set them up as binaries, and I wonder whether you can get it right the first time. Are these false binaries that she's setting up at this stage of the 21st century, when we should be prioritising energy efficiency in housing developments?
No, I think they're very real binaries, and they are things which we struggle with every day, trying to get these balances right. What you just described is the job of government in many ways. There are many competing priorities, many competing objectives. And we'd love to achieve valuing heritage, making sure we've got energy efficiency, getting the density right, doing all these things simultaneously. But that's very hard to try and get all these things, because they do work against each other. Changes to the National Construction Code to increase energy efficiency rules increase the cost of building a house, which works against an affordability objective. We know this happens, so we do every day make these decisions about what the policy settings should be. And
you will have seen, isn't part of the innovation in this sector also working out ways to create energy efficient developments at scale in an affordable way?
Absolutely. How long does this take is the question I always ask.
But isn't it a vital situation that we face right now to improve energy efficiency?
Absolutely. And it will continue to be so.
Or do we want to put people in tiny hot boxes in mass developments?
No, we don't want to do that. But we equally need to put them in houses. So this is the challenge always.
Well, what do you mean by a house?
How do we make this trade-off every single day in what we try and do? And you try and get this balance right. You know, it's no point leaving them in their car, because you can't put them in their house either. You need to try and get this balance right of all all these things, which is always the challenge. The South Australian government already moved to say we won't make any further changes to national construction code, and then the federal government has made that same commitment. Any substantial changes outside safety issues, because it increases the cost of building houses. So again, we're trading these things off to say what is the right objectives. In a perfect world, we live in a great utopian world, we get all of these things right today. And to your question was, well, aren't we in 2025? So surely we've been doing this a long time and we're all sophisticated enough to be able to achieve every policy objective at the same time. The truth is we're not there, but I don't think we can stop and say, well, let's just wait until we get all those things right before we press ahead. We are in a housing crisis. We need to keep acting like we're doing things here. And to make some progress, yes, you have to accept some of these trade-offs, which is the challenging job. And that's why we have politicians and they get elected for making these trade-offs. And our job as public servants is to give them those choices and to try and see which ones are the least risky to be able to get on and do it. You talk about government procurement rules. Another thing which we need to continue to refine to make sure we do those as efficiently as humanly possible to make sure we get all of those objectives right. To the broader question about productivity, there's a lot of questions about productivity in the construction sector, and it is hard, and Danielle's right, there are real challenges in this. It has had the slowest productivity growth of many sectors, as is well reported. To me, I think that comes largely from the fact that the construction industry is made up of a lot of really small businesses, tradies, a lot of small one- and two-person businesses. What we know is that's not where you get productivity growth from. The way you get innovation in businesses from larger companies, not from small business, which is really a struggle in this sector. Again,
I think you get some pushback from some small businesses, but yeah.
But it's not how that works. Go and look at the data. It'll show you that that's where it is. Yeah, small businesses do amazing things, but equally they're busy trying to do the accounts at night and trying to get their businesses running. They don't have big R&D sections and big ways to do innovative solutions. That's where you rely on big business. And big business is not part of the construction sector. So it's a real challenging
issue. In Australia.
In Australia. So it's a real challenging issue for them to keep doing it. But it will come. We know that they will change the way we build houses. And again, government's doing a whole range of things as we're trying to encourage some of that activity along that path. Because again, I always think of us as we're the innovation bit of this. How do we do things first? Prove it can be done. Get it down the cost curve. Make it more efficient and then make it viable for business to pick up.
David Reynolds from the South Australian Government. And rounding off this conversation I'm hosting at the National Housing Conference about whether supplying more houses is a silver bullet fix for Australia's housing crisis, and it is a crisis, just ask any renter right now, is an audience member.
Hi, Matthew Crosley from National Affordable Housing. When we talk about affordability, is the goal to decrease or drive down house prices and risk people having negative equity as a consequence, or is it a longer-term strategy to minimise growth and hope that wage growth catches up or it closes in, I guess?
Good question. Thank you. Rachel.
Yeah, well, look, I've thought about that question as well, and I played around with two scenarios in my mind. I think one scenario is house prices keep rising. Currently, I think the house is being treated, it's not just shelter, it's pretty much a very lucrative investment for many people. Now, and then I think our government policies kind of support that notion, even though government do not say it. At the federal level, there are tax concessions for holding properties and things like that. So if we want to say, all right, let's just go down this path. Housing is too late now to turn back the clock. Housing's a huge investment for lots of people. So house prices are just going to keep rising relative to incomes. If that's the case, then we have to accept the fact that inequality is going to increase. And therefore, there will be greater need for public investment in social and affordable housing.
And the flow on consequences of inequality in housing is massive. It has massive implications for employment, for health, for mental health, for
that's right.
All sorts of things.
And so I think there's greater onus on government to basically make sure that social and affordable housing becomes essential infrastructure that's spread across the entire nation for what will be growing numbers of people who will be unable to purchase a property because house prices keep rising. So that's one scenario. The other option, of course, is to say, look, it's a bit late in the day, but let's wind back the clock a little bit and just go back to the fundamentals. What kind of society do we want? if we want a society where lots and lots of people are able to own their own home because of all the security and all the benefits that come with it, then we have to make housing less attractive as an investment. I mean, that's a difficult conversation. And that does mean, a scenario where we see the house price to income ratio moderate, flatten, and dare I say it, even fall over time. But I don't really see any other way around it.
And either. Is that to also address the elephant in the room, which is tax reform?
I would say.
Well, yes, it is, because, we do.
Capital gains tax discount, negative gearing.
Yeah, that's right. And again, a key argument that lots of people would bring up, and there is some merit to it, which is that, we don't want investors to flee the market and therefore reduce the supply of rental housing. I think that's what a lot of people would say. Well, my response to that would be, we've got 2.2 million Australians who are rental investors. 30% of these rental investors own more than one investment property. So can we wind back tax concessions on the second, maybe the third property? Can we just make a start? We don't have to kind of throw the wrecking ball, at the tax regime, but we could embark on, again, some kind of method, some kind of arrangement where we actually start winding back tax concessions, maybe for the third property. Maybe
David Reynolds?
So I just want to go back to the question. The other way I think about this, instead of having to worry about reducing house prices across the board, gets back to the conversation we did have, which is, what are we building? So I think part of that question is, instead of us thinking about the totality of house prices and everybody out there worrying about, are we just trying to drop everyone's house prices, let's go back to think, what can we build that is smaller, cheaper, a different product than is out there, and focus on affordability in that market segment rather than thinking
it
as one complete group.
But doesn't that then increase a disparity of haves and have-nots? And by that I also mean the haves who get the fancy houses and the have-nots who get what's available.
No, I think
what's at the end of a long queue every time you turn up to rent a property these days in capital cities, it's a torturous experience. You're at the end of a long queue of 100 people, and what's at the other end of that queue is often an absolute tragedy of an offering.
Yeah, I don't see it that way. I think what we're doing is creating a mid-market point which doesn't exist at the moment. So where do you go first? And then how do you build into the housing market by taking your first property and then selling that and moving up later? It's something we don't think about enough at the moment. So I think that position in the property market, as we know, above public housing but below market housing, there's this gap where people just can't get in. They're the people in the queue that you're referring to. What can we offer to them that's actually something as a different product? And that's where I think the deeper conversation should go.
I think we make a lot of assumptions about who's standing in that queue these days. A whole lot of different people are standing in that queue with a whole lot of different incomes.
I do think that when they invented negative gearing back at the end of the 30s in Australia, actually, it was a pretty good idea of trying to incentivize people to develop flats. And it made some sense. We didn't expect to end up with 20% of the Australian householding class owning more than one property, that they become landlords. I don't think we saw that coming. The answer to the question, I think, is it's a really fundamental question about, what do we mean by affordability and what are the ways in which we're going to achieve it? I don't think, that's why when I started, I said I thought the government was being slightly performative about its 1.2 million homes as having some effect on housing affordability, because they don't want it to have some effect on housing affordability because of the political problem. So my answer is, it took 25, 30, 40 years to get into this mess. It's going to take 20 years to get out of it. But we do need to do the things we've heard about in the platform. On the one hand, build more non-market housing outside the system that could have some long-term dampening effect and provide shelter. At the same time, incentivize the rest of us not to overinvest in residential and landlordship, but into the innovation economy. And I think there are therefore reforms of negative gearing, reforms of capital gains and super are all required. But where's the political bravery to do it, I think, is the
point. But also one might ask, do the demographics of the political class need to change when you look at the ledger of who has how many housing investments in government at the moment? It's pretty extraordinary, the stats. Another question. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alex Meek from Department of Housing and Works here in Perth. Rachel touched on this a little bit in her intro, but then we didn't really go back to it. I'm just thinking about the other financial incentives we could have to improve the 98%. So you mentioned removing stamp duty, maybe swapping out stamp duty for higher land tax, changing retirement and, those sort of financial incentives that we could change to increase fluidity in the housing market. Any comments on that?
Rachel?
Obviously, I talked about winding back stamp duty and that would have to be replaced with a broad-based land tax. That is one major way. You can do this through planning changes as well. I mean, currently, I think there are already, planning changes that have already been made that have allowed for greater ways of modifying dwellings, for instance, to allow more occupants to stay in there. I think in South Australia, there's been the co-location where you can actually have, say, two different families living in there. And, you just kind of find ways for people to be able to occupy the same dwelling while being able to, I think, protect their privacy. I think that's what matters. There's also options, although I'm less, I suppose, convinced that this might work, but there's been conversations, I think, around perhaps reducing the capital gains tax that might be applicable to people who have spare bedrooms in their houses and who might want to then rent out a bedroom to someone who's looking for a room to rent in. You could potentially look at, for instance, if you have, say, an aged pensioner, for instance, who's living in a house with some spare bedrooms, you could potentially look at things like not counting all of the extra rental income in calculating their age pension entitlements if they were to rent out a bedroom to someone, because once you rent out a room, you basically earn extra income and that can reduce your age pension. So there are ways of doing this, I think, across numerous measures. It's just that we don't pay enough attention to it because, well, we're very focused on the 2% at the moment.
Go for it. We've got one there, and we may have time for one there. Thank you.
Hi, Rebecca McDonald from Firm Foundations. I'm an impact developer. So if I can speak for the developers that aren't in the room, I think what you missed before, you really dismissed planning, and planning is definitely not a silver bullet, but you dismissed the middle of planning, where planning can have a huge impact. And you even dismissed it again, Tim, I'm sorry, I'm going to call you out, where you pulled out the New South Wales example, which I think is actually, for anyone from New South Wales planning in the room, it is the gold standard for what is happening. Yes, it had a short-term impact on development applications being pulled or held, but I think you'll see, my guess, and based on the number of applications I know that are happening at the moment, it's going to have an incredible impact, and other states should be looking at it as something to replicate. South Australia, Queensland, if anyone's from Queensland in the room, particularly that middle and density housing. You also called out duplexes and you said it's more expensive than one house, but it now houses two families where it only housed one family before. Yeah. So I think from an economics perspective and an affordability perspective, you're looking at it from one angle, and we're looking at it from how many people can we house as fast as possible, because ultimately everybody in this room is here to reduce suffering. They're to reduce that number of people that are waiting in the line or who are living in their cars, and we desperately just want to create more housing. So anything planning can do to improve that, and from a development perspective, we just want the risk reduced, giving us certainty, which is what the New South Wales planning scheme has done. We're almost certain that I can turn a one individual family house into six new front doors if it's located within 800 metres of a transit station. That is incredible certainty from a development perspective, and you will see thousands of developers run at it.
Thank you. And I'm going to do a Tony Jones and say, take that as a comment. And it was an important comment, so thank you. I'm glad that we got some pushback for our panel. I'm going to take another question over there. Thank you.
Mike Allen from Link Wentworth Community Housing in New South Wales. Thank you for a fascinating and really thought-provoking conversation. I've been involved in the social and affordable housing sector for more than 40 years, and it is the worst set of circumstances that I've ever seen. So this is a real crisis. We've talked about some of the, or the panel have talked about some of the more immediate interventions, but this crisis is also an opportunity. How do we use this opportunity to create some longer term, more sustainable change, so hopefully we don't finish up in this situation again? And something like, heaven forbid, we might have a national housing strategy.
I'll just push the question back to you, if I can. What's at the top of your list?
Top of my list at the moment, frankly, is a national housing strategy. I'm too old to not want to have something happen that will make more sustainable, long-lasting change. And a national focus through a strategy, like some of our comparable countries, like Canada and others, that will help us, help prevent us getting in this situation again. And I was here 10 years ago, we were sitting in this room trying to work out ways to get political attention. We've got political attention. We absolutely desperately have to use it because it will fade away.
Yes. So, quick response.
No, it's just that I think Mike's right. But I think this discussion and this going out on the ABC is an important part of having a slightly different civic conversation at this point. You know, the best answer is not just more of the same, even though the last 2 years have seen some really good stuff. It's a moment to say, come on then, what are we really trying to do with this housing intervention? Who for? What objectives do we want for our young people? What objectives do we want for people from Aboriginal communities? Well, you know, to actually have the outcomes that we want from public policy and then work backwards to the methods required to achieve it, I think.
Well, Aboriginal communities would say, not your objectives, our objectives.
But it's in the strategy.
Self-defined.
It's in the strategy, yeah.
Rachel, did you want to pick up on anything?
Yeah, I'd be really in favour of a national housing strategy as long as it's a national housing affordability strategy and not a national housing supply strategy. And I think, therefore, that needs to include, the strategy needs to cover things that, like tax, it needs to cover things like population planning, proper migration forecasting, so that we actually know how many houses we need. Yeah. As the population grows. I mean, these are things, you know, they are all related to housing, and that I think it would have to be a broad-based national housing affordability strategy.
Thank you, Angela Cartwright from Better Renting. I think we've established that supply is not the silver bullet. So my question for you is, what is the one thing that we can't fix the crisis in affordable, stable and healthy housing in this country without? And I'm going to put at the top of the list a phased-in scrapping of investor housing tax concessions. I don't see how we fix the crisis in rental housing without addressing that. What do you think?
David?
I think the question for affordability me is, I'm less interested in the tax thing. That's not on my list. It's absolutely the product. I've said it a few times up here. What are we building, when and how do we do it? And innovation from government helping to lead that result.
Rachel?
Our tax is absolutely on my list. So, stamp duty reform, replace it with a land tax, winding back tax concessions for multi-property owners. So, I think.
And it's very interesting reading Alan Kohler's quarterly essay about the history of those two policies, of those policies and tax reform in Australia and what that did to house prices. It's an extraordinary read. Tim?
So we need to help the private sector maximise its delivery, definitely, but we need new other models in the market that are not as reliant as them on homes for sale. So that means the public sector directly developing in a way we used to 40 years ago.
So that question was actually going to be my last question, so that worked a treat, and we're at time. I want you to give it up for Professor Rachel DeForge, David Reynolds, and Dr. Tim Williams. Thank you all. And thanks to the Australian Housing and Urban Research Institute, which runs this national housing conference. My guests today, David Reynolds, head of the South Australian Government's Department of Housing and Urban Development, Professor Rachel VeForge from Curtin University, Dr. Tim Williams from the architecture firm Grimshaw, and he hosts the very interesting Grimshaw Cities podcast. And ABC News has been running a priced out series of housing stories and investigations this month. If you search for housing policy on the ABC News website, they'll pop up, and in some of them you'll see a form to share your experiences of the housing market with the ABC News team to help inform its reporting. And do check out ABC Radio National's new podcast series on solutions to the housing crisis, The Home Front, with Anthony Burke on the ABC Listen app. And find and follow Big Ideas while you're there, hey? Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. I love hearing from you. I'll catch you. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.